Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. On today's show, we'll feature an interview with Anne Elizabeth Moore and Matt Joint of the Unlympic Organizing Committee, a series of creative events to discuss little-considered dimensions of Chicago's bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. Public educational and governmental channels, those spots on your cable system best known for covering city council meetings and local events, are one of the last remaining vestiges of local programming in an increasingly consolidated market. But as phone providers like AT&T enter the video business, these local channels are being left behind, seeing their funding cut and their content hidden from viewers. Community television advocates are fighting back. In late January, the Alliance for Community Media joined a nationwide coalition of regional organizations and municipalities in filing a petition at the Federal Communications Commission. Helen Soleil, executive director of the Alliance for Community Media, explained that the filing relates specifically to AT&T discriminating against PEG channels on its UVerse cable television system.
Their UVerse system removes local PEG channels from their standard basic tier lineup and puts them into what they call a Channel 99, which is, of course, way above the basic tier, which is in violation of the law. The way that Channel 99 is handled makes them very difficult for people to navigate it. One of the problems is you still have to go deeper into menus to be able to find the channel.
The PEG channels also can take up to a full 60 seconds to load on the television, can't be recorded by DVR services like TiVo, and show up in a lower resolution, looking like YouTube on your flat screen. Soleil believes that despite the changing media landscape, PEG channels are still relevant and provide a vital platform for community voices.
Local voices will never lose their importance. As technology moves forward, we always seem to continue with the other technologies that we have used before. They may change and morph as PEG is and will, but we don't ever seem to leave them behind. A perfect example is radio. We all still use radio and listen to it.
To learn more about public access, go to rchannels.org.
Whether it's our computer keyboard or a cell phone, we're all holding the means to potentially communicate with millions of people. The implications for politics and government are enormous, says Mika Sifri, the editor of TechPresident.com and curator of the Personal Democracy Forum. He says the changes we are seeing now in communications are as big or bigger than the invention of the printing press.
Until a decade ago, if you wanted to speak in public and reach more than just the people you could shout at with the loudness of your own voice, you couldn't. There were gatekeepers everywhere blocking you. Either it was money or it was somebody with control of the means of communication who would decide whether or not you and your ideas were worth being shared with others.
That's all changed now, but government is still functioning in a print world. Sifri says it's time to move into the 21st century.
It shouldn't be that hard to put legislation online. It's created in a word processing program, after all. Why isn't it posted on the web as fast as it's being sent to the printer? And the answer is just archaic practices. Government has not caught up with what the technology makes possible.
Sifri says that the tools for mapping and data gathering are getting so easy that people are taking government transparency into their own hands through sites like everyblock.com.
Anything that has address data in it can easily be mapped. And so everyblock gives you a kind of very immediate awareness of what's going on around you. Type in your address, and lo and behold, you can see everything from health reports to building permits to crime reports to noise complaints to postings on Craigslist.
Smart government will take advantage of the available technology and the brain trust of the citizenry, Sifri says. For example, Vivek Kundra, the chief technology officer for Washington, D.C., initiated an Apps for Democracy contest that offered $20,000 in cash prizes for outside developers and website designers that made good use of the city's data. Kundra received over 50 well-developed applications.
Had he gone through a normal procurement process to get something like this developed from a government contractor, it probably would have taken years to get the thing built and millions of dollars. And instead, what he did was tap into the creativity of developers, of people who are, in many cases, young, talented software developers who are looking for interesting new projects.
Vivek Kundra is now on President Barack Obama's shortlist of possible nominees for the nation's chief technology officer. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The world is reorganizing itself to avoid further exposure to the most virulent strains of what is now commonly referred to as the American disease. The contagion is dreaded like the worst kind of venereal infection. This disease is transmitted through political and economic intercourse with the Typhoid Mary of the planet, the United States. As headquarters nation for global finance capital, the U.S. has acted as a vector of the current planetary economic meltdown. No country is fully immune to the ravages of the American transmitted disease. Having penetrated nearly every corner of the planet, the scourge, first spread by Wall Street hustlers, now threatens to undermine the economic organs of the entire earth. Just as with biological infections, the disease must be contained before it can be cured. That means avoiding contact with the Americans and their hopelessly contaminated financial instruments, those festering derivatives that so poisoned the U.S. economy it is virtually paralyzed. When the Wall Street plague hit Europe in October of last year, the assembled heads of state were quick with a diagnosis, but not a cure. "We want entrepreneurial capitalism and not speculative capitalism," declared French Prime Minister Nicolas Sarkozy. But speculative capitalism is the only kind the United States has been peddling for a very long time. By now, much of the world has come to the realization that the only way to avoid another dose of the American disease is to reject economic entanglements with the Americans. Meanwhile, the United States continues to incubate the infectious agents. The Obama administration is riddled with carriers of the disease, corrupt bankers and their accomplices at every level, ensuring that the pathology will continue eating away at the political economy for at least four more years. There can be no cure if you don't get rid of the germs. As the world erects defenses to keep the American disease from repeatedly infecting its global neighbors, the effect will be similar to the redlining of neighborhoods. The U.S. will fall further into decline, and it is walled off from other nations' efforts at economic development. That's the meaning of the redlining of America. The United States has been the object of redlining since at least 2003, when George Bush finally convinced the world that Washington was bad company with his illegal invasion of Iraq. Nobody wants to do business with a crazy man or a crazy superpower. By late 2005, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations decided not to invite the United States as an observer to its annual meeting, but allowed the Russians and Chinese to attend as official observers. When the U.S. sent a diplomat anyway, he was turned away. Last December, the heads of 33 nations of Latin America and the Caribbean pointedly failed to invite Washington to their summit meeting in Brazil. Increasingly, the Americans are shunned as bringers of war and killers of economies, the two most feared symptoms of the American disease. The corporations that threw their money behind Barack Obama for president were hoping his fresh face and charm would be seen by the world as a prophylactic for the American disease. But the Wall Street streetwalkers and the Pentagon refuse to change their risky behavior. Increasingly, the world has no choice but to put them in isolation. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. We now feature an interview with Anne Elizabeth Moore and Matt Joint of the Unlympic Organizing Committee, a series of creative events to discuss little-considered dimensions of Chicago's bid for the 2016 Summer Olympics. The following interview was recorded on Saturday, February 14, 2009. We are joined by Anne Elizabeth Moore and by Matt Joint, who are organizers of the Unlympic Organizing Committee. It's spelled UNLYMPIC, not to be confused by the Olympic.
Yeah, it's totally different.
Different thing.
Right.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is the Unlympic Organizing Committee for listeners who may be unfamiliar with it?
Well, the Olympic Organizing Committee is the sort of organizing body that really forwards this giant, sporty, mega event that sort of travels from town to town. Theoretically, we've really only been in Chicago for a couple of days. actually, about a month now. Wow. And we are set to hold sports, not sports, and things that sort of aren't even close to being sports, as a way of raising debate about the Chicago 2016 bid coming to town.
I see. What have been some of the events that you've held thus far?
So far, there have been three Saturday events. The first of which was the opening ceremonies, which started with a parade and kind of a passing of the torch by way of...
Totally illegal sparklers.
Totally illegal sparklers.
Oh, that's great.
Indoors, which almost caught the floor on fire.
Only lit one man on fire.
And then right. there was a parade of notions versus the parade of nations, wherein people came dressed as either the...
We had French theory.
Yeah, it's hard to quantify.
We had toxic blood.
We had new unnamed nations. We had the idea of agriculture and finance. The parade of notions, whatever notion you wanted to represent, you could show up to the parade as. And then let's see.
Well, next week we have class conscious kickball and then live action role play family dinner, which were completely bizarre.
Yes.
Class conscious kickball, of course, we had to shovel a foot and a half of snow out of the way to actually play on the field. Then we had a fashion competition. And then last week, we had the spelling bee, of course.
Mm-hmm. But the class conscious kickball, I think in particular, even though it was such a strange event, just being in the space of Washington Park and seeing the actual physical zone that would be destroyed to build this temporary future ghost dome was kind of amazing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And to be like, wow, this is a staple in this community that's going to be destroyed without any sort of
public debate.
Yeah, no public
question,
debate whatsoever.
Awareness. And of course, looking around at the housing that is in the area, which is the housing that's sort of slated to be a part of the future Olympic Village, and of course it's not going to be up to code, it's going to be destroyed, new things are going to be built there, and actually having people from that community come out and play kickball with us was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a testimony to what the park space does inside of communities too. I think it's a common loitering space for positive loitering, I think, where we met people, who lived on the block that had no idea about the events and then were just there in the proximity and joined us in playing, and we became friends with them, which it's like, so pretty much the event did exactly what this space is here for and why it needs to last in
the way that
sense.
It exists
yeah.
right now. Mm-hmm.
And we're recording this. Where are we for listeners?
We're at No Coast down in Pilsen,
okay.
1500 West 17th Street, which is a great art space.
Mm-hmm. And you have an event slated for shortly after this recording is finished.
It's true. We're going to be having the Emotional Games, the final event in the Winter 2009 Olympiad, which is, do you want to present what the Emotional Games are?
The Emotional Games have a few different elements to them, which are going to be hopefully both hilarious and also kind of like sobering.
Emotional.
Sobering, yes. Basically, we're going to be doing a number of games and having some amazing guest speakers from Tanzier 10 and the Campaign to End the Death Penalty. Kind of like giving this duality of this fun night of karaoke, but also with a sort of weight behind it too, where we get to hear kind of these like elements of, you know, socially engaged Chicago in the context of celebrating Valentine's Day, which is wholly awkward and awesome in its own way.
This entire festival is about awkward and awesome. But yeah, it's at 7:15, hopefully we're going to actually be speaking to Stanley Howard, who is currently in prison, was formerly on death row and then was commuted by George Ryan, as I understand it, and was also was part of the Burj torture case. And so being aware of the sort of international human rights abuse issues that come into play in, you know, as we talk about whether or not Chicago should be hosting this sort of international celebration of
culture,
and you know, brotherly love across various boundaries. It's an important, I think, the most important event for us to actually start setting up the deeper arguments in case Chicago is chosen to be the host city in 2016. The deeper arguments behind what the issues that need to be raised in Chicago.
And that might be the next question I might want to ask. Everyone within the major media apparatus, not just in the United States, perhaps worldwide, deem the Olympics as the glory of sport and youth and an opportunity for the nations and cultures of the world to set aside their differences and peaceably engage in sport. And someone who might not know anything about some of the larger concerns regarding the Olympics might say, you got a problem with that? What would you, how would you address that question? It's like the Olympics are supposed to be a positive force for social change, or at least they're trying. And why are you trying to rein on that parade?
Because the at least they're trying part is where it gets really tricky. They're trying, but they're not really engaging with communities and creating an open and democratic process for deciding how the games will be hosted, or how much they will cost, or who will even pay for them. And then in the meantime, of course, by accident, without trying to do it at all, the Olympics has, in the last 20 years alone, displaced over 2 million people. And actually, the system of displacement of low-income people in order to bring the Olympics in was started in 1936 when Adolf Hitler had the Olympics in Berlin. And in August, the games started, and in June, he built the first concentration camps. And that's a pretty significant moment that we have to start looking at, and that has been built into the Olympic movement now and is sort of the part that we tend to overlook. And Atlanta is the most important case of this. It displaced 9,000 homeless people in 2 years, in the 2 years leading up to the games, and since has displaced something like 230,000 more people under the same laws that were enacted. That's the danger that Chicago in particular has, but I think all U.S. cities, and then eventually, hopefully, all international cities will realize that this the way that this system works is not good.
And it, one thing that we've had to clarify, I think, kind of over and over again in interviewing about this, is that we're not against the idea of this brotherhood coming together under sports. It's not like we're just art dorks that aren't coordinated enough to, you know, enjoy or ever participate in anything
we're
like that.
We're obviously very good at them. I've won 2 silver medals myself.
No, but it's more how it happens, not that it happens. That it happens is a great idea. It's how can this idea actually happen in an ethical way that's based on democracy and not on coercion and sort of like secret bid processes like we've seen here. The elusive bid that we now have even is bizarre and kind of hard to like
determine. And it's all sort
can
of
you elaborate on that
code.
It's like how is it elusive? I mean, it seemed like it was straightforward. You see ads about it. Procedures about that are ostensibly made public. What is there something else going on here?
The procedures about that are made public after the bid is submitted to the International Olympic Committee. Okay. And it was in the works since the sort of early pre-bid, I forget what it's called, the preview bid maybe, which was submitted to the IOC in June. At that point, the IOC actually said, your finances here are kind of unrealistic. Chicago took it back, and Chicago 2016 committee, I should say, took it back and started working on it some more, and then just resubmitted it on Thursday. only publishing it then, making it public on Friday. So even after they had submitted our city as the host city for these 2016 games, they weren't even going to let us know until 24 hours after they had sort of put in their bid to the IOC.
And what's been the sense of that development since it's been public? I don't know if you've had a chance to actually look at the bid since
it's
been submitted.
Well, the bid, of course, I mean, the part of the problem here is that Chicago 2016 is an organization that's, first of all, a lobbyist arm. They want the Chicago, Chicago to be the host city of the 2016 Olympics.
Right.
So they're not really a neutral party, and they're the only organization that's actually gone to great lengths to put information out about the possibility of hosting the games. All the information has been positive. Wow, what a coincidence. They're also working really hard to sort of build support for the games. They're also, though, backed by Hill & Knowlton, which, of course, we remember as being the company that got us into the first Gulf War and doing various other... Exactly. And so they're not about providing accurate information, and yet all of the accurate information that the city is basing its decision on supposedly is the information that Chicago 2016 is putting out. So we're making decisions about the future of our city based on this PR firm that wants to host the games.
And that's largely made up of people that don't actually even live here.
There's apparently about a 50% breakdown of people that live in Chicago and people that travel with Hill & Knowlton to just
sites.
Bring the city the Olympic Games.
Hmm. That's interesting. What has been the... suppose for a moment that Chicago does not win the Olympic Games. Mm-hmm. You count that as a victory, it would nonetheless still go to either of the other competing cities, and there's no sense that what we might avert here might happen, perhaps even worse, in Tokyo or Madrid or Rio de Janeiro, mm-hmm. should they win the 2016 Olympics. Mm-hmm. What's the give and take about that?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot. I mean, Rio de Janeiro, it would be probably disastrous for the same exact moving the low-income housing opportunities out of the city mm-hmm. reasons that it would be disastrous here in Chicago. But at the same time, the Olympics has never actually been held in South America. So there is a lot of reason to do that. However, I do feel pretty strongly that in the very near future, people are just going to realize that, like capitalism in general, something about the Olympics just doesn't work and we need to abandon it.
Mm. Suppose for a moment that Chicago doesn't win the bid and all of these changes that we seem to be taking place with regards to the city might not succeed, or would they be abandoned? Or I would read the situation myself that they'll still proceed apace with a lot of the changes, perhaps for a future bid in 4 or 8 years, perhaps for just accelerating the trends of gentrification and displacement of poor people that you might find. What's your take on this?
Hmm. Well, for one, the actual bid doesn't include very many actual changes. There's only supposedly one hotel that's going to be constructed in downtown Chicago, which I completely don't believe for a second, but the fact that that's the information that's being put out in the bid is pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So if we don't end up getting the bid and we still proceed with those plans, it'll still appear to be acceptable. The other big project, though, that we expected to see in the bid that we didn't was an overhaul of the CTA, and there was actually no improvements made to the CTA in the bid.
And that was sort of the first buzz that got people excited and on board about the games in the first place. And when I started hearing about the possibility of Chicago being the new host site, it was always through the outer loop. The outer loop that we're going to be receiving that's going to connect all of the impoverished neighborhoods into the circle. No, just kidding.
Yeah.
None of that, actually.
Did we say outer loop? We meant that we're going to be able to ride on the CTA.
Let's return back to what you're doing here, the Unlympic Organizing Committee. You've held these events. What's been the response there? You've talked about one response, but I've also find it in other media, and there's been something of a positive buzz that you've been creating. What have your events been doing in the way of outreach?
It's been so much fun. I think the most important sort of fun, amazing part of it is that I've met all of these amazing people
mm-hmm.
that have just been excited about this question. Not even excited about, like,
let's tear it down.
Let's tear it down. Let's shut it down. Let's whatever. Yeah. Whatever. But about, like, hey, no, this should be something we get to discuss and participate.
Yeah, and how can we engage in this sort of practice of demanding democracy in all sorts of life, not just even in this. This is almost just like an instance to look at to remind us how little democratic process is involved in our everyday lives. You know, it's kind of interesting in that way because people are like, I never thought about this. all my money is going to this thing and I have no involvement in it. That is insane. How did that happen? You know?
Right.
How am I under this,
right.
Like
they say it's democratic and then it's not. We can change that because that's what democracy is. But also we've also had of the last three events we've had around 50 people at each one, and they've been almost completely different sets of people each time, and which has been just the funnest part of it. Like, wow, a totally different crowd. Like, we're community building on one hand. Mm-hmm. We have a sort of a core that we're working with, but also just great, amazing, random people coming in at every event that are just joining in this questioning process. It's right. Super great.
That's awesome. Tonight, as we're recording this, is the last night. What happens next with the Olympics? Are you finished? Are you going to do next, or is that yet to be determined?
We haven't determined it yet. We're kind of waiting to see what pans out and maybe planning some preemptive work, but then also responding work too. Okay. Mm-hmm.
In April, the IOC will visit Chicago and determine whether or not it's a good place to host the games. There are a number of lot of organizations that are planning responses to that are sort of direct action based. We will probably just continue in our Olympics mode and plan something that's a little bit more questioning and fun based.
Right. Going to those other community responses you might see, mm-hmm. This is probably something that a lot of people listening to this might not know very much, if anything, about. Mm. The fact that it's just been rah rah, Chicago might get the Olympics.
Sure.
But a lot of, not just the Olympics project that you two are organizing, but the fact that there are a lot of people in Chicago who are none too pleased about this fact and have been expressing it or are poised to express it. What's been that like? Can you talk a little bit about what you know about that?
Well, we did. I mean, the first event that we held, the last poll that had emerged stated that 88% of Chicagoans wanted the games. The one that I looked up today, that Chicago Tribune started yesterday, instead theorizes that 78% of Chicago doesn't want the game. And so
these
over
are
the
both
last
in the trip.
Dramatic yeah. turnaround there.
Over the last 4 weeks, obviously it's become a pressing issue and people have started to question it and they've started to look at the numbers and they've started to look at the finances and the actual bid. And they've come to a decision. And it does seem to now be a consensus, near a consensus. 78% is at least fairly enormous for Chicago to get behind anything.
And who can totally say, I guess, what if we can quantify, like, what amount of that is thanks to things like this happening?
Right.
Because maybe part of it, too, is this general, like, you come upon an idea in its abstract form, and you're like, wouldn't that be great? And you see, in a hopeful vision, people uniting, holding hands, like, walking around the streets of Chicago, and then when you think about the finite and the definite realities of what it will do to the world that you live in your immediate community, then you start kind of questioning a little bit more and kind of going into the, you know, minutia of what that would entail for the city. And I think part of it has just been this awareness factor of people slowly coming into contact with, you know, maybe this is actually going to hurt us and here's why. This kind of, you know, question versus just the initial vision of grandeur, I think.
But I also wouldn't, I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot today as we sort of think about closing up this project temporarily, maybe. We've talked to hundreds of people. I think that there is some degree to which we can start to say, like, we've presented a pretty interesting thing. We've engaged people in a pretty interesting way. Mm-hmm. And clearly they're doing more engaging than we were ever very successful at. Mm. And I think, you know, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but I think that the point is that there's a lot to be said for creating a positive sort of joining project that people want to get involved in and do work with.
Definitely.
And I guess two last questions. Have you deemed this to be a success in terms of, let's say, media outreach? I mean, you've been able to, I've seen a couple of articles about this. What's been other people's awareness of people who haven't participated in these Olympics about the Olympics?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we get a lot of people from, I mean, I probably had 15 emails from Vancouver alone yesterday.
Because they're hosting the 2010 Summer Winter Olympics.
2010 Olympics.
And they're extremely organized and already ready.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, but asking like...
they've had a jump start for 5 years now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. True.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So they've been excited about it. So obviously, and that's, you know, technically international, but sure. Sort of not so much.
Well, and I mean, the NPR coverage as well was
NPR
very...
NPR was great. Of course, we haven't had TV coverage, which would be kind of fun.
That would be fun.
What a great visuals. Especially your karaoke tonight.
Definitely. Uh-huh. And I guess the last question. For folks who might want to learn more about the Unlympics or might want to participate, and not only participate, but also join in with helping on the organizing of the Unlympics, what can they do?
Unlympics.wordpress.com.
Spelled UNLYMPICS.
Yep, okay. And then WordPress.
Right.
Com is COM.
Okay.
And there's also a Facebook group that may or may not continue into the future, and various Googling options.
And part of our whole goal with this was to be as democratic as possible. So anytime someone emails and says, hey, what's going on? Can I put my hand in? Can I take charge of some element of this, we're like, please.
Yeah, that's pretty much guaranteed to like get the next Olympics going.
Yes.
Or it could even be something like an ongoing series of events.
Right, sure.
Who knows?
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. We have been speaking with Anne Elizabeth Moore and with Matt Joint, co-organizers along with a number of others of the Olympic organizing committee here in Chicago. Sure. Anne and Matt, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was an interview with Anne Elizabeth Moore and Matt Joint, recorded on February 14, 2009. Again, the website for the Unlympics is unlympics.wordpress.com. Unlympics is spelled UNLYMPICS. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.